You're listening to Just Women on Brooklyn's Radio. You can join in by emailing any comments or questions you may have to justwomen@brooklynsradio.co.uk or check us out on Facebook. Search for Just Women at Brooklyn's Radio. Just Women is just what you need.
Hello and welcome to Just Women. This is our weekly talk show here on Brooklyn's Radio, when we chat to some interesting local ladies about their lives, work and subjects they are passionate about. I'm Anne Twist, and this week I'm delighted to introduce three guests interviewed remotely by myself and two of my colleagues, Jackie Mitchell and Amanda Weller. In this programme, we are going to be talking about mindfulness techniques, cake baking and sugar craft, as well as a rare cancer called epithelioid hemangioendothelioma. To kick off today's programme, here is my colleague Jackie Mitchell chatting with Kish Madassia from Lead Your Life.
Hello there, Kish.
Hello, Jackie.
Thanks very much for joining us and welcome to Just Women.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
So before we get into your work as a mindfulness coach and instructor, it'd be very interesting to find out a bit about your background, how you became a mindfulness coach and instructor.
Yes, in my previous role, I worked for British Telecom, where I was a computer programmer. And in 1988, I became the pioneer home worker in British Telecom in what I term as prehistoric times, before we had laptops and PCs, email, Wi-Fi, or even the internet. And I had quite a challenge getting to work from home, but it eventually did happen. And I used to do documentation work and so on. And then I made my way from a computer programmer to project management and a facilitator, and also got my coaching qualification while I was there.
Rush, that's quite a transition, isn't it, from your work today? So how did you make that transition to become a mindfulness coach and instructor?
Well, part of doing the coach training and becoming the coach made me really realize how much I loved working with people. And so that really made me want to do that even more. And the mindfulness was just an insight from a colleague, a fellow coach from Sweden. She and I had got together at her place in Spain to explore how we could work together. And she said to me, "Oh, you can teach mindfulness." And I looked at her completely shocked, thinking, "What is she talking about?" And she said, "I was on a very brief mindfulness workshop before I came out here. And I've observed you the whole week." She said, "You meditate, you love watching nature, you stop before your meals. You need to teach some of this stuff to other people." And at that stage, I was really crying because she touched something very deep within me. And I just said I didn't want to talk about it any longer.
Yeah, yes. It obviously resonated something inside you.
Yes, it did.
And so then what happened?
And then as we had a couple more days there, and then at the airport, she said to me, "I'm going off to Sweden and I'm advertising a mindfulness workshop. And you're going back to London and you're going to write the content of the workshop and you will be coming to deliver it." And she just went off. And I was like, "Oh, my goodness." Anyway, I went, when I got back home, I tried to put the content together and it literally just flowed. You know, I just put together from all the different things I've done in my life. I've meditated for 40 years. I've been involved in various spiritual learning organizations. So I just picked different things from different spaces and put it together. And then asked two of my very good friends if they would give me some honest feedback on what this content would, you know, felt like to work through. And they said it was great. Then before I went off to Sweden, I started with the workshops in my home. And got one person sometimes, 5 people, 10 people, and it just grew from there. And the workshop in Sweden was an absolute success.
Oh, that's wonderful news. Fantastic. Well, for those of us who don't know, perhaps you could describe what is mindfulness.
Yes. Yeah, so the actual description of mindfulness says mindfulness is about being in the present moment, accepting what is without judgment. And I think those last two phrases are really key, because we don't always accept what is. We're always wanting to change things. And the judgment part, of course, we judge in milliseconds. And that's for me as well as everybody else. We're all kind of conditioned to think in that way. But the other key thing is about practicing presence. So I think some people think, oh, maybe mindfulness is about mantra chanting and that maybe you've got to, you know, join a sect. It's none of that. It's just about practicing presence. So if you're doing the washing up, it's about really being present with that washing up. If you're out in nature, then it's really about being present in that space and noticing what's around you. If you're having a conversation with somebody, it's about practicing presence and really listening to them rather than wanting to respond. So it really is about being in the present moment.
Yes, because the tendency for a lot of people is to look into the future and look back in the past and not take any notice of what's going on around them.
Yeah, you've absolutely hit that on the nail. Because, yes, we spend so much time looking at the future of what we want things to be like and the past of what things used to be like, whereas we don't really spend enough time in the present moment. Also, we think something like 60 to 80,000 thoughts a day.
Wow.
And so there's a myth that when you practice mindfulness or meditation that you empty the brain, but you can't really empty the brain of that many thoughts. So what you really want to learn to do is observe those thoughts. And then when something comes in, just kind of letting it go by focusing on whatever it is that you're doing in the present moment.
And you also equate it to a bank balance, don't you?
Yes. So, you know, we go out to work or we have our business or whatever we have in order to bring some income into the home, to pay the mortgage, pay for food, etc. And we always make sure that that's at a positive so that we can manage that. And in the same way, I suggest that we have an emotional bank balance and we learn to top up that emotional bank balance regularly so that when challenges hit us, which of course they always do, we're in a much more stable position to handle those challenges. And I ask people to top that up by a minute at a time and then top that up by 5 minutes a day. So it's quite simple to put into practice because there are thinking out there that say, do mindfulness for 20 to 30 minutes a day. But I think that if you're told that, the immediate reaction is, I don't have 20 to 30 minutes a day. Whereas 1 minute seems very achievable.
Absolutely. 1 minute seems very reasonable. Perhaps you could give us a few examples of the mindfulness techniques.
Yes, I'd love to do that, Jackie. And I think the main one, the breath is the foundation of the mindfulness work. And the breath is with us 24/7. So what I will do is just talk us through a very simple breathing exercise now that people can use at any time. And so if we just become aware of our breath as it is, there's no need to change anything at all. It's simply about witnessing the breath. And as you're witnessing that breath, if there's any thoughts coming in, just let them float away like clouds. By coming back to the breath and using that breath as an anchor. Again, just witnessing the breath. Observing the breath. And then just come back to the feet on the ground. Notice your body. And just take a moment to scan and feel what's going on for you here and now, having done that.
Well, that was a wonderful exercise. I feel much better for that, I must say.
Okay, that's great.
Really good. Yeah, so that's fantastic. And there are also other techniques that you teach, aren't there, like writing from the heart?
Yes. So I think one of the things we've lost as the advent of mobile phones and computers have come is that we forget how to put pen to paper. So really writing from the heart is a really important skill. It really brings you into the present moment because the pen hits the paper. And it's just about writing whatever's coming to you. And sometimes it could be just, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. But you'll be surprised at what can come out and how it can help you to just really get stuff that may be sitting within you come out in a lovely way. There's also around gratitude. We can learn how to just have a gratitude journal and maybe write down three things that we're grateful for. In the Western world, I say that we're materially rich and emotionally poor. So if we can find things to be grateful for, that's a very simple way to bring in a bit of mindfulness into our daily lives.
And I think some of the other techniques are listening to music and also mindful eating.
Yes. So, and listening to, we've also, with music, we always seem to now make music a background noise rather than something we sit with. And so I share with people how to just sit with a piece of music, even if it's just 1 or 2 minutes of it, and just see how that feels. But there's a lot of scientific evidence that with the advent of telephones and mobile phones, etc., we tend to just become very left-brained. And with music, it uses both sides of the brain. So it's a great one for bringing in balance. And I say to people, and also when you put the music on, how about dancing and just letting your body flow a little bit, because it's a great way to just exercise and get those endorphins going. And the mindful eating is, it just needs a minute. It's like, say you're sitting with a cup of tea, just think about the ingredients that are in that cup of tea, you know, the tea leaves. What route or what journey have those tea leaves done and taken in order to be in that cup in front of you there and now? From the time it was grown in the ground to the time it takes actually to grow, with the soil and the sunlight, water, when it's picked, packed, transported across the world, put onto a shelf before it comes into your home. That's just one ingredient. And I have a lovely Zen proverb that says, if we're sitting in front of a plate of food, and we can do the same analogy and say, in this plate of food, I see the entire universe supporting my existence. And it's a very simple way of having a minute.
Yes, that sounds very, very good indeed. Yes. And of course, these techniques can really help people reduce stress and anxiety, can't they? Especially in these present times, living through a bad pandemic.
Yes, very much so, you know, because I think one of the things we have to remind ourselves is the pandemic is a really tough time. We're having to calibrate not just weekly, but daily. And one of the things that we forget to do is look after ourselves. So by bringing in the mindfulness and self-care, you're topping up that emotional bank balance. But we've got to remember that the more care we take of ourselves, the better we are for the people around us. And so really self-care is a very much part of this work as well.
Absolutely. And then working from home, most people are working from home these days. Do you have some tips about that?
Absolutely. So when we're working from home, you know, it's really important to have a structure, really have a start time, a finishing time. Make sure you're having your tea breaks. Make sure you're having a lunch break. Sit down and have a meal. Go for a walk around the block, even if it's a few times around the block. You know, and when you're walking around the block, really be present to what's going on, the people you're passing, maybe smiling at people, you know, noticing the trees outside, even if they're on the pavement. Really making time for these kind of boundaries is important. And also your workspace. I have a client who the only way she could have a workspace was because she's got a really small flat. One chair was for work and one chair was for home. And she said, what she shared with me was, that sounds like it's really insignificant, but it actually was a really big change in her mind when she went from one chair to the other.
That sounds a marvelous idea, that.
Yeah. And you know, my catchphrase for my work is small changes, big impact. And that's what this is about. You know, the 1 minute a day of mindfulness, the boundaries, all of these are really small changes that we can all make, which can overall have a big impact, not just on ourselves, but on those around us too.
And of course, you do online courses and workshops via Zoom. Can you tell us a bit about them?
Yes. So the online workshops and courses, I mean, the workshops are one-off where you get some simple, basic, you know, learning about mindfulness. And also on the courses, it's a six-week course, 1 hour every week, really covering in depth the different aspects. So you've got breath, gratitude, mindful eating, writing from the heart, creativity, and then the final one is where we're bringing all of those building blocks together. Each of those sessions is an hour, and we have them weekly, because then that gives you enough time to bring, say you're doing breath the first week, you bring in all the different techniques of the breath, because we just shared one little technique on this call today. But there's just so many aspects of that. And then you're building the blocks, and you're also bringing in your own kind of ways that you have of coping. So by the end of 6 weeks, you will have a wide variety, but you will have built the muscles of bringing in that, you know, emotional bank balance into your life.
And you also do webinars for companies, don't you, for their employees?
Absolutely. And that's been a big growth factor in my business over the last year, especially during lockdown, where I've had lots of companies getting me in to do mindfulness sessions for their employees, for their well-being. A big law company that's done that, a private health insurance company, financial company, an event company. So it's been a real wide range of companies, but at the end of the day, the message is the same for each and every one of us, about self-care, about boundaries, and about bringing presence into our everyday life.
Okay, then. Well, thank you so much, Kish, for coming in and talking to us about this. Would you like to give us your website details so people can get more information?
Yes, thank you, Jackie. The website is www.leadyourlife.co.uk. And if you follow me on Instagram, which is Morthy Wisdom, MOTIWISDOM, there's lots and lots of resources on there, and you'll find tips that I'm giving regularly.
Okay, then. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jackie.
That was Kish Madhazia, mindfulness coach and instructor.
Thank you, Jackie, and thank you also to Kish. All very thought-provoking in these stressful times. Time now for a short break, after which I'll be back chatting with Sally Baker of the EHE Rare Cancer Charity.
You're listening to Just Women on Brooklyn's Radio.
The new variant of COVID-19 is spreading fast. Around 1 in 3 people with COVID-19 don't have any symptoms but can still pass it on, putting people at risk of serious disease and renewing pressure on our NHS. Vaccines give clear hope for the future, but the rising infection rate requires action now. Once more, we must all stay home. If it's essential to go out, remember, wash your hands, cover your face, and make space. Stay home. Protect the NHS. Save lives.
I'm so glad you're open.
Thank goodness you're here.
Do you ever close?
Did you know the pharmacy at 20 Church Street, Weybridge is open 100 hours every week to meet your immediate medical needs? We're here for you from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. weekdays, 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Saturdays, and 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Sundays. Our friendly and knowledgeable team can provide you with the advice you need, as well as helping you with repeat prescriptions, all the over-the-counter products you would expect, and if you can't get in to visit us, we will deliver to you. The Pharmacy, 20 Church Street, Weybridge. We're here when you need us, 100 hours every week.
Hello, my name's Sarah Chaplin, and every Thursday night I host a show called Jazz London Live at 10 o'clock until midnight, and each week I play a selection of jazz, funk, fusion and Latin. I feature an interview in the first hour of the show with somebody on the British jazz scene, a gig guide rounding up the gigs in the week to come, and in the second hour of the show there's Album of the Week, in which I play 3 tracks from a brand new album that's just come out, and also a long track in the second hour of the show to help you wind down to bedtime on a Thursday evening. It gets a bit more mellow towards the end of the show. So if you love jazz, you're going to love this show, Jazz London Live on Brooklyn's Radio. If you're not sure whether you like jazz, give it a try. You might find there's some tracks in there that you really love.
This is Just Women, every Tuesday at 1 o'clock on Brooklyn's Radio.
Welcome back to Just Women with me, Anne Twist, introducing our guests and presenters this week. Our next guest today, interviewed by myself, is Sally Baker of the EHE Rare Cancer Charity.
Sally Baker, welcome to Just Women. It's lovely to have you on the programme.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. Now, we're going to be talking about the cancer charity that you set up with your husband, Lenny, about 5 years ago. That's the EHE Rare Cancer Charity. Before we do that, let's just find out a little bit about you, where you live and sort of family situation and sort of past life, etc.
Nothing very exciting. I'm
I live in Kingston with my husband and three children, although two of them are in their 20s, so not really children, but and then a 16-year-old as well. And we have a dog who keeps me busy. In the past life, I was a special needs teacher, worked at a school for children with severe learning difficulties, which was pretty challenging but enjoyable. Then we travelled quite a bit with my husband's work. So we lived in Australia, Cambodia, Russia. We had children, two of the children in that time. So it was all quite adventurous and exciting.
Yeah, really exciting.
It really was. And great contrast of countries. Cambodia was probably my favourite, just because it was so different. And now we're back in Kingston. And
all in one house. All locked down. Yes. Lots of cooking.
Absolutely.
Two boys in their 20s. That must be lots of food.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to be talking about the EHE Rare Cancer Charity. As I said, I think you set this up about 5 years ago, yourself and Lenny. Could you sort of tell me kind of what led to you setting up the charity?
Yes. Well, let me tell you a little bit what EHE is.
Yes.
It stands for Epithelioid Hemangioendothelioma, but obviously as it's such a long name, that's why we shorten it to EHE. It's within a group of cancers called a sarcoma. And sarcomas are in bones and soft tissue. Sarcomas themselves make up about 1% of all cancers. And EHE is probably about 1% of sarcomas. So that gives you an idea of how rare it is. So EHE itself is a vascular cancer. So it involves cells that line the inside of the blood vessels. And these are called endothelial cells, which is what's in the name, and epithelioid, which is also in the name, refers to the elongated shape of the cells.
Right. Okay.
So now, what causes? I won't go into the great scientific detail because most of it goes over my head because it's very, very complex. But basically, EHE is caused by gene mutation. So some genes in the DNA cross over, so they're in the wrong place, and this in turn creates a new protein, which is thought to lead to the abnormal growth of the endothelial cells. But it's not known why that happens, what causes it, what makes it become aggressive. That's not known at all.
No.
It can appear in anywhere in the body. Common combination is liver and lungs. It's what is called multifocal, in that it can often appear in more than one place at a time. So yes, liver and lungs is quite a combination, but it can be in people's bones, in their spine, just in their lungs, just in their liver, in their leg. It could be anywhere, really.
I've been reading about this, and as you say, it can be anywhere, and it can be sort of dormant for years, and then it can become aggressive, and then it can go into remission. And so it's a very unknown, unpredictable quantity, isn't it?
It's incredibly unpredictable. I'm lucky. I have the indolent type, and I've had it for 15 years, and it's never really changed in that time. But equally, it could suddenly become aggressive, and no one would know why or what triggered it. And then other people, it can be really aggressive right from when it first gets diagnosed. So you know, it's a hard thing to live with psychologically.
Yeah, sure.
Physically. So. Yeah, and I mean, if I explain a little bit about how I was diagnosed.
Yeah, that'd be great. I mean, sort of symptoms, typical symptoms, that sort of thing, I think would be...
Well, there aren't really typical symptoms. That's the problem. I started off with pains in my right side, which I put down to gallbladder and then had various tests. I won't go into the whole detail, but it led to a whole series of scans, the first of which was a CT scan, which they obviously picked up. I remember a particularly scary appointment at the Kingston Hospital, where I was told that they'd found multiple tumours on my liver and my lungs. The doctor looked at me rather amazed that I was getting a bit upset. But and then they thought they were secondary cancers. Anyway, it carried on with a whole process of scans. I had ultrasound, CT, MRI, full body radioactive scan, mammogram, PET scans, and it was a complete roller coaster, because I'd have a scan and they'd say, oh no, it's not cancer, and then I'd have another scan and they'd say, yeah, but something's not quite right, we'll send you for this scan, and then they'd say, oh no, we think it is. And I had, and this went on for 6 months. Because they didn't know what it was, but they knew something wasn't right. Of course, that takes a very emotional toll on you, because you're just constantly going for scans. You're getting, you know, oh great, it's not. Oh no, it is cancer. Oh no, it's not. And it, you know, it's
horrendous. You don't know where you are from one day to the next.
No. And of course, I had the two boys were 5 and 7 at the time.
Yeah.
6 and 4 as I was going through this. So that was, you know, all I could ever really think about was them. So it was a real roller coaster. Anyway, I finally got diagnosed after a second biopsy and told that I had this very rare cancer. There's no known cure, but they did explain that it could be indolent, you know, sort of stable or aggressive. So they then put you on something called watch and wait, which basically you just leave it there and you have a scan every 3 months to see if it's growing, and then another 3 months and another 3 months. So that leads to what people in with EHE call scanxiety, because you've been this scan and it gets very stressful, because you then you obviously have to wait for the result. The scan itself isn't particularly stressful. It's the result that,
of course, it is.
So, you know, and you're doing that every 3 months, and obviously I've been lucky that it has to remain stable, and now 15 years on, I have a scan once a year.
I was going to say, I didn't realise it was every 3 months. I thought it was once a year. So it was 3 months initially, and now it's yearly.
And then 6 months, and then they just gradually, and now rather than CT scans, I have MRI scans, because obviously it's not safe to have so many CT scans. So now I have MRI scans, and touch wood, you know, so far still stable.
Which is fantastic,
Which is fantastic. But one of the problems of having a very rare cancer is you don't have anybody else to talk to about it. You can't, I mean, you can find stuff on the internet, but it's usually very scary.
Yeah.
So for quite a few years, I just buried my head in the sand and tried to just, you know, get on with it. And then somehow I found a Facebook group of EHE patients, a closed group, so you have to, you know, not apply, but, you know, to get accepted. So I went on that, and that was great for support, although it's a bit of a double-edged sword, because you get the support, but then a lot of people have died.
Okay.
Which is tough.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
My husband Lenny, for us to start with, sort of said, what earth do you go on that for? Why do you go on that? Because, you know, it's obviously scary.
Yeah, it's bringing you down, potentially.
Yeah, yes. So it's sort of double-edged sword. But it then became apparent, as numbers grew in the Facebook group, that the key to getting research was to fundraise.
Yeah.
Because also being very rare, you don't get any funds from any of the main cancer charities or any government grants or anything. So we basically, within the Facebook group, it was decided that we should set up charities. So there is, in fact, a charity in the USA, a charity here in the UK, and a charity in Australia. So they're all sister charities.
Oh, okay. So it all came about the same time then?
Yeah, we all set them up around the same time. And Lenny got involved at this point, and that's just his sort of thing. You know, he likes a project. He loves to get involved in something. Yeah. So really, he was instrumental in setting it up. And it's just sort of grown. So it was set up 5 years ago. It's called the EHE Rare Cancer Charity, shortened to EHERCC, .org.uk, which is the website. And we've sort of gone from strength to strength. It's really incredible for such a tiny little charity, you know, how much money we've raised. Plus,
oh, no. I saw 800,000 until September last year. I mean, where did that come from? How did you get that?
It is unbelievable, really. We've had, I mean, in the UK, there's probably about 20, 25 patients. I'm not exactly sure of the numbers. But some people obviously don't get involved. Some people are very involved. And we've had charity balls. Some a lady's husband and five of his friends did a cycle ride from Land's End to John O'Groats. And then they did a charity ball at the end of that. That raised a huge amount of money. Wow. We've had smaller things like quiz nights and race nights. And so the daughter of a patient had this fantastic idea of just encouraging people to put a jar in their house. And like every time they've got like the odd bit of loose change, pop it in the jar.
Yeah.
And they got called Jessie's Jars because her name was Jessie. Her name is Jessie. And it's fantastic. And we have a jar in our house. And when we actually empty it out, there's probably about £150 in there.
Amazing. Yeah.
Just from popping in the odd 2p's, 1p's, 5p's occasionally.
Yes.
And it fills up. And that's such an easy way to raise some money.
Yeah. And definitely.
Yeah.
So that was 800,000 up until September last year. And I, you know, I've been to one of the quiz nights. I wasn't aware of the other sort of things you've been doing. How is that looking, you know, at the moment for the year ahead? And, you know, how's it been affected by COVID?
It has been affected, obviously. We had a quiz night planned and, you know, other people had events planned. We had 40 or 50 runners booked to participate in the London Landmarks half marathon last year, which was due to run in April. And that obviously got cancelled. And we had riders for the Ride London event, right, which also got cancelled. And they're quite big fundraisers for us.
Yeah.
Yes, we haven't been able to do any of the other normal sort of fundraising things. So at the moment, we're quite a good little community. And we've just recently set up like a fundraising group, a support group. So we're trying to just get organised in that respect.
I was just thinking about that when you said we. I thought, I hope this isn't just you and Lenny. So it's people across the UK who have EHE themselves or have maybe a family member have kind of joined in. Is that a fair assessment of it?
Yes, yeah, patients and their families. Predominantly patients, really, but then obviously their families get involved. So so yes, it's just a matter of just coming up with ideas and you know, trying to run with them. Hopefully this year we're getting up to our 50 runners for the London Landmarks half marathon again, which at the moment is due to go ahead in May, but who knows whether it will or not.
Yeah. Fingers crossed. I mean, I know there are other ways that people can sort of contribute, regular sort of one-off regular donations on with gift aid, etc., and then just one-off ones. So but also people just potentially kind of thinking of their own little fundraising events. As you say, any amount is well received, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had some close friends of ours where he just decided to get sponsored for shaving all his hair off. I can't remember how much, several hundred pounds. And you know, just small things like that. And the money, every penny goes to research.
What you spent the 800 on.
I mean, of course, it's combined with the charity in America, who obviously do actually raise much more because the majority of patients seem to be in America.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's such a huge country. Yeah. And they, in fact, just got a couple of huge grants. Because I think as a small charity, you have to show that you can raise your own funds before you will get outside grants, etc. So they've just received some big grants, but we've got quite a lot of research projects going on in America and in the UK, researching all about EHE, really. I mean, they obviously haven't come up with it yet, but they're just trying to understand how it works. A researcher in America has actually created a mouse model. So because the problem with something that's very rare, not only is it hard to get the support, but it's also hard to get tissue samples and blood samples because there's not very many patients. And so we're trying to set up a biobank so that those things can be captured and used for research, because that's one of the crucial difficulties, is trying to get enough tissue samples, etc., to enable the researchers.
Yeah, of course. People can't do research on something that they can't actually handle or deal with. Yeah, okay.
So these things are having to be worldwide things,
yeah,
just to get enough patients.
I mean, in terms of numbers, I think you said, did you say 25 across the UK, 25 people in the UK estimated to have it?
I mean, our Facebook group now has about 2,000 people. And that's not just patients. That's obviously patients, friends and family. But I mean, it has really grown, I guess, as people become, get diagnosed, and of course they Google it now, they can find those things. Whereas when I was diagnosed 15 years ago,
it wasn't available.
There was nothing.
Probably wasn't even so Google.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Would you believe we are already out of time? So it always goes so, so quickly. So I'm sure, you know, there could be listeners out there who would like to find out more. If you could just tell me again the name of the charity so they can, because there's bags of information on there, isn't there?
So the charity is the EHE Rare Cancer Charity.
Yeah.
The website address is www.ehercc.org.uk.
Brilliant. Okay. Well,
there is also an Instagram and an open Facebook group for the charity as well.
Oh, that's good. That is good. Well, that's brilliant. I'm sorry, it probably feels very, very short. It goes so quickly. You know, it's a big topic, so we were always going to run out of time on this, but there's a lot of information on there. And, you know, hopefully this interview might be listened to by someone who you know, could go straight to that and realise that, you know, actually this thing they've been worrying about could be this, maybe. I don't know. If it's so rare, maybe not. I don't know. But
You just don't know.
Anyway, thank you so much for joining me. And it's been brilliant having you, and good luck with everything.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Very welcome.
Oh, well, it was great to catch up with Sally and to hear about the progress herself and Lenny have made with the charity. It's brilliant to hear how she's turned her own situation into something which provides support for the wider community. Time now for another break, but please do stay with us as we'll be back with my colleague Amanda Weller chatting with Erica Galvin of Iced Innovations.
You're listening to Just Women on Brooklyn's Radio.
There's no doubt that running a business is tough, but at the moment it's even tougher than ever. And that's where we can help. Plan C are a team of Surrey business professionals offering free advice for local businesses during these testing times. We offer solutions to your most pressing business challenges. From marketing to human resources, PR to Google Ads, business strategy to website design. Post your questions at yourplanc.co.uk. We'll put them to the team and come back to you with our thoughts, observations, and most importantly, practical solutions. It's a free service, so why not see if we can help? www.yourplanc.co.uk.
As well as listening live to Brooklyn's Radio, you can listen on demand to our podcasts of interviews and feature programmes at brooklynsradio.co.uk. Check out the programmes and features by clicking on the show logos and keep up to date with the latest podcasts on our latest podcasts page. The Sound of Surrey, on demand at brooklynsradio.co.uk.
If you love film music of all kinds, then Hunter's Hollywood Hits and Brit Flicks is the show for you. Every Thursday, escape into the exciting world of the movies with soundtracks that transport you right into the films. From special shows dedicated to legendary composers to theme shows dedicated to different genres, you can hear a mixture of classic themes as well as well-known songs that feature in films. So, all you film fans, be sure to catch Hunter's Hollywood Hits and Brit Flicks with me, Suzanne Hunter, every Thursday at 9 p.m, only on Brooklyn's Radio.
This is Just Women, every Tuesday at 1 o'clock on Brooklyn's Radio.
Welcome back to Just Women with me, Anne Twist, and to introduce our third and final guest, interviewed by my colleague Amanda Weller, here is Erica Galvin of Iced Innovations.
Great to have you here, Erica.
Thank you, Amanda. Nice to be here.
Well, perhaps could you tell us, to start with, a bit about your background and how it all began for you?
Well, I grew up in South Africa and spent 27 years there before coming to the UK in about 1995. And I started doing cakes, inspired by my husband's aunt, who did Sugarcraft and made our wedding cake. And I was blown away by what you can do in sugar. So that's really what got me started.
How amazing. So her talents then opened your eyes and inspired you.
Yes. And since then, the first thing I did when I moved to the UK was enrolled in an evening cake deck class up in London. And from there, there was no stopping me. I absolutely loved what I did. So very fortunate position when I first had my children. I stopped work and managed to turn a hobby into a business.
That's the ideal, isn't it? I mean, that's everybody's dream, I think, to be able to do that. I wanted to ask you, actually, about your, just briefly about the training. I believe you went to Brooklands College and did a certificate there. What did that, was that a full-time thing, or was that the evening class you just...
No, I started there in about 2002 and just felt that I wanted to get a qualification behind me if I was doing cakes professionally. So I went in and enrolled in the course. It was a four-year course, just one day a week, but that gave me a chance to be a stay-at-home mum, look after the kids, as well as developing myself.
How fantastic. And did the course, was it purely practical, and or did it also touch on the business aspects of things as well?
No, sadly, there was nothing to do with business. That's something I've just learned over the years. It's a very vocational course where you learn all the tips and things. But going back to the old-fashioned ways of doing cakes, rather than using all the moulds and modern-day equipment, so all the royal icing techniques, all the piping, modelling, we touched on sugarcraft, and just loved the course.
And... yeah, just magical stuff that you create. I have to say, I've done a bit of delving before chatting to you today. And the things that you create are absolutely, absolutely stunning. I would say, from somebody who was told to give up art, speaking for myself, that I find it absolutely extraordinary that the creations that you make out of sugar, because they're, you don't buy in any of your... I don't know, flowers or animals or anything. I presume they're handmade, are they?
Yeah, everything is handmade. So I make all the sugar flowers. Love making sugar flowers. I love to start with a real flower. So I study the botanics of it all, pull a flower apart to actually see the insides of the flower and then work on the outsides. I've also done lots of courses with amazing floral tutors over the years and always changing my technique as well to just perfect it so they look really, really realistic. Also, all the animal models and things are just lovely to make. I love modelling, and I'm very excited to be going up to Scotland to do a course on how to make a flying unicorn. So that's going to be very exciting. That's not for my business, really. That's for me. That's just to allow my hobby to still be a hobby as well as being a business that I've grown it into.
Well, that was what I was wondering, because often when we do something as a business, the joy that was there as a hobby can actually be knocked away a bit, can't it? And I think it's if you can maintain that love and enthusiasm and passion for it.
I think being a cake decorator, you have to have the passion, because the hours are very antisocial. It's a highly stressed job where you've got deadlines all the time. Friday night is not a normal person's Friday night. It often involves sitting at my desk at 3 o'clock in the morning and sometimes with a glass of wine even, trying to get wedding cakes finished, because it's a balance between getting the cake as fresh as you can for your bride, but still giving enough time to work on the cake. So a cake that's very highly decorated, that you can't do all the decorations beforehand, you're under a lot of pressure. So it often involves a lot of hard work the night before the wedding to get it perfect for the bride the next day.
Oh my goodness, I'd never thought about it all being so last minute, I have to say.
On the upside, though, Mondays are my day off. So I don't have Monday blues.
Oh, gosh, that's funny. I love that. So do you have other people helping you, or is it you creating all these?
No, it's just me, the making and the baking. And yeah. I work from home out of my kitchen, which is 5-star hygiene rated by the Elmwich Council. I think you have to. It's just a duty of care to your customers, also fully insured, and done all the hygiene certificates and things as well. I do work on my own, but that's the way I can control about what orders I take on without relying on anybody else.
Yes, absolutely. I totally see that. Going back to the hygiene rating, what does that involve? I would imagine that's quite a few hoops you have to go through for that.
Yeah, it varies from council to council. The Elmbridge EHO, they're actually there to be your friends. They're not there to pull you apart. They just want the best to make sure that you are operating hygienically, and they do give you very good tips and things. But the most thing is just having your cleaning under control, your cleaning schedules, etc., just buying your ingredients from reputable people, your eggs, for example, that they're all salmonella free and they've got the Lion stamp of approval. I try to use all organic products. I also try and use all the ethically sourced things like vanilla and chocolate, which is important in the whole green society we need to be nowadays.
Increasingly so. And do your clients actually... Is that a big thing for your clients, the fact that everything's ethically sourced and organic?
It's important for me.
Yes.
And that's the way to go, really, because it's got to come from within the company. And I do feel you're not on the cheap and cheerful side of things. I'd rather do less work beautifully and properly and ethically than just be... just do sort of a supermarket. There's nothing wrong with supermarket cakes. There's a market for everybody.
Well, that's not your market, clearly. No. So with still thinking about ingredients, are you finding that more and more people have requirements as far as, you know, allergies and all that sort of thing? Is that something that crops up quite a lot for you?
Definitely it's changed a lot. I've been running my business for 15 years and it's definitely changed a lot, especially in the last sort of 5 years. Main thing is the gluten intolerance and gluten-free cakes that I do. Egg-free cakes have always been around, and I've always done egg-free cakes for customers, from a religious point of view or from a health point of view. But so many people are gluten intolerant nowadays, although I don't do cakes for celiacs because that's a whole new ball game. My kitchen is not registered as a gluten-free kitchen. I do have flour and other products in there, and I do use the same tins and mixes for my baking. So I'm happy to do cakes for gluten intolerance, but not for celiacs.
No, fair enough. Okay, I understand that. So with a view to your amazing... I had a browse on your Facebook page, I have to say, and I know that your focus now is wedding cakes and these sort of big celebration cakes, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
And I have to say, I was just completely blown away by some of them. And then you had cakes with cascades of flowers just dripping off multi layers, and it made me think actually of the poppies at the Tower of at the Tower of London years ago. Did you see that?
Oh, they were amazing,
weren't they? Amazing. And your cakes have that same effect, some of them. So tell us about your client interaction and your approach for each project that you're given.
Okay. I tend to meet a lot of my brides at wedding fairs, or they find me online and send me an email. So I do a little bit of backward and forward, just chatting about their design and their requirements for their special day. And then from there, if we're on the same page and thinking about the same thing, then I invite them for a consultation and tasting, which is one of the best parts of planning your wedding. And it's also a nice place for the grooms to be involved and come and taste the cakes. So I offer them a choice of flavours for them to taste before they choose which ones are going to go into the wedding cake. We sit down then. I just ask them about their lives, about their day, about possibly their wedding stationery, their bridal gowns, the flowers they're having, and any other quirky thing that they might have at their wedding. For example, I had brides earlier in the year who were getting married at Brooklyn's Museum on the Concorde. So they were really, really quirky couple, which were amazing to work for, and they just chose the best cake ever. It was such fun to create for them.
Can you tell us what that
was? Yes, they chose, it was a two-tier suitcase cake with a big globe on top, and it was two ladies getting married, and one was a pilot. And she clearly didn't want to make it all about her and her career, so she just chose a Moldovan seaplane to go on top of the cake because they were going to the Maldives on honeymoon. And then I did all shells and two little passports, and they loved travelling, so all little country badges all over the suitcases as well. And it was just brilliant, loved doing it. And the cake was a rainbow cake inside as a shout out to their sexuality. And then they took it on honeymoon and sent me a photograph of the rainbow cake with a bottle of champagne, some glasses, and with the sea and the Maldives in the background. It was just fabulous. Lovely couple.
Oh, what an amazing thing. Your cake travelled to the Maldives.
Yes.
That's absolutely wonderful. What other stories, what other sort of memorable cakes have you done?
Well, another one I did was really funny too. Did my sister's wedding cake, and she got married in Natal in South Africa, and she wanted to, well, I offered to make the cake, which was a bit weird, and being me being here and arriving the day before the wedding, but I did it. I baked the cake and popped the cake into my hand luggage and walked around Heathrow Airport with my travel bag with my knees bent, trying to keep it as flat as possible. And a big shout out to Virgin Airlines. They were absolutely brilliant. They stored the cakes in the staff fridge for the overnight flight. So they kept nice and cool, and I got to Natal, iced the cake when I got there, and it was perfect for the next day.
How amazing. Because actually, I did wonder when I was preparing for today about transportation of these, some of your very delicate designs as well. How do you manage that? Safely.
The best thing nowadays, because cakes have got tall and skinny, so there's a lot less to imbalance them, and it's more difficult to transport them, and also the semi-naked and buttercream cakes nowadays as well. So I tend to transport them all in separate boxes and then construct the cake on and build the cake on site.
And does that include sort of putting on, the flowers or the decorations on top? They're all stored separately.
They'd all be stored separately as far as possible, and then transported in boxes and then carefully set up on site.
So you might need hours there beforehand.
It normally takes me about an hour to set up a cake, depending on what it is. I mean, some cakes are easy and quite straightforward. Other ones, where especially with the fresh flowers, they all have to be arranged hygienically onto the cake, so that there's no the flowers come in contact with the cakes, because a lot of flowers obviously are sprayed with insecticides and pesticides now to keep them fresher for longer. And also a lot of flowers are toxic. For example, gypsophilia, which is really popular on cakes, peonies, it's poisonous, ivy's poisonous. So there's a lot of things that people have to consider when they do choose their wedding cake and what flowers are going to go onto their cake if they have fresh flowers rather than sugar flowers.
Gosh, yes, a whole new aspect that I had never given any thought to, I have to say. And how do you find running your own company and, sort of managing all the diverse aspects to running a business like this?
Yeah, on the plus side, it's given me the freedom to actually be a stay-at-home mum. My kids are grown up now, so it's not really applicable now. But you do have the freedom of hours, so I can work nights instead of during the day. So that's the advantage of being self-employed. It is a lot of hard work, as I mentioned earlier, very stressful. But the passion, it passes that. There's a lot of admin that people don't realise goes into cakes, because you're not just the baker and the maker. It's the sourcing ingredients, it's the marketing, it's the sales, it's the purchasing. It's just being organised all the time, really, because there's just so much more to the business that you have to be on top of things all the time.
It's true, isn't it? There are so, so many aspects of it. Well, unbelievably, all this has gone incredibly quickly. I could chat to you for a lot longer about all of this. I mean, I just wondered if somebody wants to start icing and having a go. I know you run workshops, but as a sort of a tips?
Absolutely. I think just being organised and just knowing your target market, your perfect client, because there is a market for everybody. There will never be too many cake decorators out there. So believe in your product, believe in yourself, and make cakes that you want to make.
That's fabulous. And if anyone should want to get in touch with you, what's the best way, Erica?
I'm on social media, so Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, but mostly Instagram. I've also got a website, which is www.icedinnovations.co.uk. Otherwise, just give me a call, and I just love to talk all things cake.
All things cake. Well, thank you very much for coming onto the show, Erica. It's been really interesting chatting with you. That was Erica Galvin of Iced Innovations.
Thank you very much, Amanda, and to Erica too. That all sounds delicious. Not great for my Be Good January resolutions, however. So I'd like to thank all of our guests this week on Brooklyn's Radio. That's Kishma Dasia, Sally Baker and Erica Galvin, and my fellow presenters, Jackie Mitchell and Amanda Weller. So if you know of someone who you think would make a great guest for our show, please email to justwomen@brooklynsradio.co.uk. We'd love to hear all about them. And to hear about past guests, go to the Just Women page on our website, brooklynsradio.co.uk. And to find out what's coming up on the programme, go to our dedicated Facebook page. That's facebook.com/justwomen.br. So this programme will be repeated at 8 o'clock on Thursday and then available via our catch-up service online. So that's all for this week. It's a goodbye from me, Anne Twist. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.
You're listening to Just Women on Brooklyn's Radio.